Anyway, I'm Brian O'Shea from Los Alamos National Lab for the one, possibly two of you that I haven't met before today. Anyway, I'm going to be talking about simulations of POP3 star formation, and I'm trying to be a little bit forward-looking here. So this is the hopeful part of my title. What's next? So anyway, I do want to thank the workshop organizers. I know that this kind of thing is a lot of work, so you know, my hat's off. So, also, I'm definitely trying to spark some discussion here, so I'll be a little bit... I'll try to stir up some trouble. Anyway, so the big question that we're dealing with when we work on simulations of POP3 star formation really is, what is the initial mass function of population 3 stars? So, I mean, this is the holy grail of POP3 star formation, and of course, all star formation. So one point of this talk is really to sort of give an overview of simulations of POP3 and also talk about where we need to go. So, you know, like I said, feel free to jump in at any time if you disagree with me. So anyway, but more specifically, I want to talk about three different things. So what have we learned thus far? The history of simulating POP3 star formation is not that long. It really only sort of spans my professional career, which isn't all that long. Where are we right now, including some results that are hot off the presses as of this morning? And where do we need to go next? So anyway, where are we at? So let's see. So there have been a lot of simulations of POP3 star formation. So here's an incomplete list. There have been a few major groups that have been working on this problem. And so, of course, there is the ENSO consortium, cabal, whatever you want to call it, Tom Abel, and then Greg Bryan, Mike Norman, myself, now Matthew Turk, John Wise, a bunch of people at several different universities. And so that's these people here, and then I don't have the ones that haven't been published yet. But anyway, this is all work that's been done in a cosmological context using the ENSO adaptive mesh code. And so I'm not going to describe it unless anybody wants me to. Then there's sort of the second contingent of people, including Volker Brahm et al. And Naoki Yoshida et al., who have been working with Gadget 2, a version of Gadget 2 that has sort of all of the same chemistry and stuff in it, but that's an SPH method. So those are the two fundamental methods that we can use. So those are the two groups. And then also, I've put several Japanese scientists who have been looking at this problem, but typically not using cosmological initial conditions. So coming at it from a somewhat idealized sense. And so, what was that?
Well, I would like to know
in
Japanese.
Oh. Oh, whoops. Yeah, never mind. So, anyway. Yeah, great. This is recorded. Anyway, but the point is, these are yellow because I really want to focus on the cosmological simulations, and I want to focus on those primarily, well, I'll get into it, but primarily because I think that these are more believable. So anyway, but over the years, the 6 or 7 years that most of these simulations span, we've spent all of our time going to higher spatial resolution, better dynamic range, more physics, so on and so forth. So what have we learned from using hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of CPU hours on this? So more specifically, what have we learned about POP3 stars from simulations of star formation in a cosmological context? So first off, and this is pretty obvious, is that the chemistry and cooling of molecular hydrogen, this is including deuterated hydrogen, suggests that we get more massive stars than in our galaxy. And so this is a plot from one of Naoki's papers. And all we're looking at here is the cooling rate per molecule, so ergs per second, from as a function of temperature for molecular hydrogen, HD. But the key thing to see is that H2, molecular hydrogen, is not the world's greatest coolant, and it's particularly lousy once you get down to a few hundred degrees Kelvin. And so, practically speaking, if the temperature of the gas can only drop to a few hundred degrees Kelvin, whereas in the galaxy, the temperature in molecular cloud cores is on the order of 10 Kelvin, then just from simple fragmentation arguments, you know, genes mass, T to the 3 halves over rho to the 1 half, that temperature's higher, so clearly the mass is higher. And I believe that this was first suggested by maybe Martin Rees back in the 70s, if not earlier. But it has really sort of been only shown recently in simulations. So, and then of course there's also HD, which is a more effective coolant at low temperatures, but non-fantastic. And so it's possible that you can use deuterium or HD to cool down to the CMB temperature, but at the high redshifts that we're interested in, this temperature is still something like 40 or 50 Kelvin. So one would expect there to be a fragmentation, you know, larger fragments due to that. Paulo.
Those curve stops where the cooling would drop to zero, or stops because it's not being computed further?
I think it stops because it wasn't computed further.
Where does that HD to H2 ratio come from?
That was arbitrarily chosen by Naoki.
Because it's two orders of magnitude higher than VAH.
That's right. So I think the reason that he picked a number that was so high was that typically in the situations where you expect HD to be important, so this paper was on star formation within H2 regions, so ionized gas, you expect HD to form sort of out of proportion. Tom, you look like you wanted to add something.
It's versus H2, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the H2 is only kind of minus 3.
Yeah.
Right, but that should basically track T2H. Okay.
No, because the H2 is only 10 to the minus 3 of hydrogen. So this value corresponds to 10 to the minus 6 of deuterium. So every 10th deuterium atom is in the molecule.
This is where the fact of more. That's because there's fractionation, I think.
Right.
Right. That's what I said. So.
You have fractionation
of
lots of isotopes like that.
Sure. No, it's not.
Yeah, in fact, deuteration at low temperatures is extremely common. You see, you see molecules like ND3, which, if you just everything reported proportional to DH, it wouldn't exist.
But it might be that the deuteration should be temperature dependent, so it could be
that's right.
Lower temperature that's plausible.
That's right.
Higher
temperature. Sure. Yep. Okay. I don't disagree with any of that. All right. So the other thing that we've learned from all of these simulations is that it's very important to simulate the formation of POP3 stars in an appropriate context, so within cosmological structure. So what we're looking at here is just from some simulations that I did with Mike in the last couple of years. We're looking at projections of log baryon density and log temperature, mass-weighted temperature, at the proper scales shown below. And so this is all, essentially we have followed the evolution of a halo, a cosmological halo, this thing right here, which has a mass of about 500,000 solar masses, and that's dark matter plus gas. And we've allowed this to evolve from a redshift of about 100, which is maybe 15 million years after the Big Bang, down to when the gas at the core of this halo collapses at a redshift of maybe 19 or so. I don't remember the precise number. I'm about to tell you. So hang on. Hang tight for just 1 second. So what we have here is a single clump. I'm not going to call it a star. I'll get into that in just a second. But a single clump forming in the center of a cosmological halo. And so, let's see, what other caveats do I want to add to this? So this is ignoring the presence of a UV background, so photodissociating or ionizing. And if you're looking at the formation of the first star in some cosmological region, that's a pretty reasonable assumption. There will be primordial stars forming in the presence of radiation backgrounds, and I'll get to that momentarily. So what are we looking at? So here we go. This is the baryon density. The halo mass is about 500,000 solar masses. It has a virial radius of maybe 100 proper parsecs and a virial temperature of about 1,000 degrees Kelvin. So we're looking at the virial radius about here. You see the two filaments that are, the filaments that are feeding gas into this. And down here in the temperature plot, you see relatively cold gas in the filaments that's been shocked up to the virial temperature, which is about 1,000 Kelvin. So then zooming in, and then of course you can see this is a log plot, so it's extremely centrally concentrated in the halo. The density profile goes as about 1 over r squared, a little steeper than that actually. So then when we zoom in a little bit further to a few parsecs, so just this central area, you see this very round thing. It's because the core of this halo is pressure supported. And again, there's one blob in the middle of this. We don't see any fragmentation at these scales. And so we're looking at temperatures of maybe 1,000 Kelvin here. So what happens is the gas at the core in the core of the halo cools down to a few hundred Kelvin, typically contracts down to the point where you have an H2 fraction of maybe one part in 1,000 and a density of maybe 10 to the 4 particles per cubic centimeter. At this point, the gas is an LTE, so it's not cooling terribly effectively. And as you go to higher densities, it typically warms up somewhat. It's still cooling, just not terribly effectively. So it can contract. And so that's what you're seeing here is hot gas. And then when we zoom into fractions of a parsec, you see this thing, which clearly, I mean, we're looking at it from the side, but it's disk-like. It's not really a disk. And then looking at it sort of another order of magnitude in, you see this oblate blob. It's not rotationally supported, but it is spinning. So when we look at this kind of thing, typically the Keplerian velocity, or the rotational, the circular velocity is maybe half the Keplerian velocity or a third of the Keplerian velocity. So it's not really rotationally supported. It's mostly pressure supported. And then when we finish, we have this single hydrostatic core, which has gas raining down on it at really high rates, significant fractions of a solar mass per year, and this blob, this sort of reservoir of high density gas around it that's feeding it. We essentially, this part, I mean, this inner parsec or so, is evolving so rapidly that it's essentially sort of decoupled from the universe at this point, outside of a couple of parsecs. So the evolutionary timescales are quite fast. Let's see. Well, I mean, the halos are very typical halos by cosmological standards. So dark matter simulations of structure formation indicate that halos don't really have much angular momentum. I mean, it's a random merger process that makes them, right? So you wouldn't expect there to be a tremendous amount of ordered angular momentum. So we see the same thing in the gas, effectively.
So the structure basically has very little angular momentum.
That's right. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, but that's true. To get down to these scales, angular momentum really isn't an issue up to this point.
That's only because you have effective angular momentum transfer. If you conserve the angular momentum,
When you say effective angular momentum transport, are you referring to numerical, or are you referring to? Just within.
My understanding of the simulations is that you get a turbulent angular momentum.
That's correct.
Somehow we're able to turn that off. As you said, it's rotating in like a third Keplerian.
That's right.
If you conserve that angular momentum, it wouldn't be able to contract very much.
That's correct. And actually, the way I would say this is just that the gas at the core of this halo, you know, around the inner sort of fraction of a parsec typically has, if you characterize it as turbulence, you know, there's sort of a transonic turbulence, Mach number of around 1. And this does facilitate gas with low angular momentum sort of jostling its way into the core. So, yeah.
The fact that you have
All right, you first.
How you appear to be growing in the center of your disk structure there. So how massive is the disk compared to that area of concentration?
I will get into this a little bit more in a few minutes, but hold that question. Don't let me forget to answer it.
I'm just going to make the comment that fact that you have a flattened structure there means that there is angular momentum. There must be angular momentum.
That's right. That's right, and it's going to be more important as time goes on, and I'll talk about that, Costas.
You mentioned there is a hydrostatic core at the center.
Yes.
Why can you see the temperature structure?
Because we're looking at too large of a scale. So the pixels here. That's right, but I mean we're talking sub-pixel scale here. So in the most recent simulations, which are done by Matt Turk, we see what's essentially a hydrostatic core with a mass of about 1/100 of a solar mass, and so we're talking scales of maybe 10 solar radii or, you know, somewhere around there, 10 or 100 solar radii. So it's way smaller than the pixels here.
Okay, so
that's why you're not seeing it.
Then you don't have a hydrostatic.
That you can't see it here. So when we go to higher resolution, you'll be able to see it, and I'll show you some pictures in a few slides. So, anything else?
So you're
one more.
This thing is now decoupled from the rest of the universe, sort of undermines the point of this slide, right? That you have to do this.
I don't think that it does. So I think that So I guess what I'm getting at is that in order to get to the point where we can accurately simulate the sort of inner region of one of these cosmological halos, we definitely have to follow the evolution of the structure that this gas forms in, because the thermal state of the gas, the chemical state of the gas, depends on this fairly complicated path that it took to get to the center of this halo right here. So I suppose, I mean, you could easily go ahead and extract this and simulate that now, but to get to the initial conditions that created this, or to get to the conditions that created it, you have to follow the cosmological evolution, because the other simulations that I've chosen not to talk about today assume extremely idealized initial conditions that are wrong. So, great. Okay.
How did you get these things?
These things? Mm-hmm. That's filament. Those are filaments. So when we do a cosmological simulation, what we do is start out with a Gaussian random field of density and velocity perturbations at sort of the few percent level, extremely high redshift in 100 or something like that. And as you allow this to evolve in an expanding universe, the overdensities collapse, and that's what comes out. So I'd be happy to show you some movies at some point. Not during this talk, unfortunately. So, let's see. Any other points that I want to make about this?
Yeah, I don't think so. Could you answer the question, why is it so important to do it in a proper cosmological context?
So, I thought I sort of answered that. So, I mean, my argument is essentially that you want...
I guess what takes an answer, because... As you know, the first stars, depending on where you are, they're bright, and you've done this, and they're variety of redshift. So
that's right.
The physical conditions can change quite substantially.
That's right.
And now the question is, but above the universe of physical conditions, you're saying that you need this small subset that is cosmologically appropriate rather than some that you just make up out of your head. So
that's correct.
What are the crucial parts of the initial conditions that are necessary?
So the crucial part of the initial conditions. So, well, I guess let me rephrase this question in a way that's more convenient for me to answer. Not that I'm not going to answer it. So essentially, the two things that seem to strongly control the properties of gas in the core. So essentially, in the core of these halos, at let's just say 1 parsec, where the number density, the mean number density, is around 10^4 particles per cc. The bulk properties of this core are molecular hydrogen fraction and temperature, right? Which are related, of course. In the simulations that I've done, there seems to be a strong correlation between, well, here. So there appears to be a strong correlation between these properties, the amount of molecular hydrogen you end up with in the core at this sort of at this period where the density is about 10^4 particles per cc, so that's really the quasi-static contraction period that leads very rapidly to collapse of this halo, you know, collapse of the gas at the core. And the amount of molecular hydrogen that you have and the temperature of the gas changes strongly with redshift, and it also changes strongly with halo environment. Okay, and when I say environment, what I mean is sort of mean overdensity. Well, we can, you know, cosmologically, you can characterize the halo environment by just taking the mean overdensity in, you know, of everything within 10 virial radii. And the combination of, let me put it this way: if you looked at all of this, if you looked over the whole redshift that you believe Pop 3 star, or the whole redshift range of Pop 3 star formation, and in a lot of different halos in different environments, I think that you could get a very reasonable range of parameter space, which you could then go ahead and simulate. Use that to simulate.
You were criticizing implicitly some of the famous Japanese like Francesco.
Right. I'm never going to live that down, huh?
And I thought your point was that presumably they tried to just pick conditions that they thought would be reasonable, but they not brought about a simulation. They made up density, their temperature, something like that. And
that's right.
They were saying that I inferred that because they did that, sometimes their conclusions don't agree with what you get when you actually have other simulations.
That's correct.
You just said there's a huge range of possibilities.
That's right.
I just wonder, what are wrong initial conditions?
Well, one of the other real issues with these simulations, or those simulations, that they make other simplifying assumptions. For example, some of the simulations that Omakai has done have assumed 1D spherical or cylindrical symmetry, where the idea is, well, most cosmological structure forms within filaments, so let's do this in 1D cylindrical symmetry, and then evolve from some initially hydrostatic set of initial conditions. And then he found interesting results like apparent fragmentation at sort of 1 solar mass and 100 solar mass scales. So thus the idea of a bimodal IMF. But when you do this in cosmological simulations, we don't see that kind of fragmentation. So really, I think that in terms of... So I suppose I should revise the way that I say that, no less.
I mean, in some sense, right? Yeah. Of course you can characterize what you find in the simulation.
That's right.
You know, if you want to do an isolated simulation, well, you know, you can use these properties. Use this angular momentum, and in particular, right. Use this much turbulent support, and also use this density. And I think all you're applying is that in the past, people took, you know, uniform spheres, solid body, no turbulent, and they form very different structures. They collapse into disks.
That's right.
Fragment, and that's not consistent with what you find in cosmological simulation.
That's true, and I am oversimplifying, I think. I mean, there are other... I think that that temperature, H2 fraction, and so on are the most important things, but there are other components to the initial conditions that people didn't pick, and there's such a large parameter space, just given the dimensionality of it, that it's hard to sort of pick that without having done the cosmological simulations and looked. And I definitely don't think that we've explored the entirety of this parameter space either. So... does that answer your question, more or less? Great.
So how many measures did you deduct on the payload that day?
Let's see. I didn't count. I'm sorry?
How many major measures did you have, like ratio 1 to 2?
I couldn't tell you for this particular halo, but I mean, we're looking at a 500,000 solar mass halo at a redshift of 20.
I assume that you get these all three.
There have been a significant number of mergers. Could you say that again?
I assume you have these top three.
Yes.
In 3 sigma or 4 sigma peaks.
Between, yeah.
Right, so if that's the case, then I would assume that they have almost no mergers.
Typically,
Yes or no? You kind of see two blobs there.
Yeah, they say we see, they definitely merge. There are definitely mergers.
It's just, you'll have to go into the, you know, what exactly you define as merger. I think what you'll find interesting here is that the actual genes mass of the gas. That's what's interesting for the gas.
No, forget the gas.
It's hard to forget the gas for the star formation.
Don't put the gas into this picture. Yeah. It's complicated for my brain.
There have been. So there have been, it is definitely merged. I couldn't tell you how many sort of 2-to-1 type mergers there were.
I can easily see what the gas would you say, because the filaments must be dominating the feeding of the gas, right?
What you would have found interesting is that below the genes mass, only the dark matter is merging, because the gas has not fallen into the
halo.
It drives very little, you know, nothing actually in the gas, only as you get, you know, just above the gene mass, and these are just a little bit above the gene mass, it's really the gas falling.
Because I think I was just trying to connect that to the angular momentum issue, because the angular momentum in dark halo is coming from the torques that the other halos are giving to them. So if you are going to have merges, then the angular momentum is gone. But if you have like few merges on the dark matter, I'm not talking about the gas, then the thing must be talking quite a bit, especially if it is on a high density of far away. So you can have a specific angular momentum as high as 0.1 or so.
And you do see that in simulation. I haven't seen that high in any of my simulations, but I haven't done enough to really explore the tail. So, well, if you take a look at this paper that's referenced right here, I talk about all that stuff. So, you know. Okay. Can I go on? All right. You sure? Okay. All right. So the other things, one of the other things that we've learned is that there are a lot of variation in, number one, formation redshifts, and number two, halo environments. And this turns into a lot of variation in accretion rates. And so the two plots that I'm showing here are from the same paper by Mike and I. though other people are starting to see similar things, I think, where what I'm looking at here is the accretion rate across a spherical shell. So this is a bunch of different simulations that have all different cosmological realizations, halos of sort of a range of masses, where the gas at the center has collapsed up to high density, in this case 10 to the 10, 10 to the 12 particles per cc. And then at this sort of end of my simulation, where I stop it at this density, I then start estimating accretion rates in a spherically averaged way, which is not a particularly great way to do it, but it's all we can do. So then what we're looking at here is m dot at a mass shell that corresponds to an enclosed gas mass of about 100 solar masses. The same in all of these. And so what we notice that's interesting is that if you take this, if you measure m dot for all of these simulations that are all at roughly the same point in their evolutionary state, there's this very, very strong correlation between accretion rate and redshift. And so, also, interestingly enough, there's a very strong correlation between accretion rate and halo environment. And so, delta 20 is just the mean overdensity, or the mean density of this gas. So it's rho of all of the gas within 20 virial radii of a given halo over the mean density of the universe. And so we're looking at reasonably overdense regions here. And there's also a strong correlation. And so essentially what it comes down to is that these halos have formed in different ways. They formed by merging more rapidly. In halos that are hotter at higher redshifts, you typically have hotter objects, for example, at a given mass. And this, at low temperatures, increases the formation of molecular hydrogen. So when the halo, when the core of this halo finally starts to collapse, then since there's more molecular hydrogen at this point in time, you have colder gas. Now, and since this contraction is roughly quasi-static, you tend towards a shoe-type similarity solution where the accretion rate just goes as a temperature to the 3/2 power. And so, I expect that at some point in the evolution of all these stars, at some very small scale, they'll all converge to some kind of very similar solution, since they all have the same chemical composition. But the point that I get at when I look at these sort of 100 solar mass or a few hundred solar mass scales is that this gas is the reservoir out of which the star forms. So that since the reservoirs of gas surrounding our protostar have these very different properties, that means that all of these protostars are going to have different evolutionary tracks onto the main sequence because they're accreting at different rates. So what that means is still not terribly clear, but you can understand this in terms of how halos at higher redshift form more molecular hydrogen. Halos in overdense regions tend to form more molecular hydrogen. So there's a very tight correlation there.
I'm not sure I understand the plot on the right. So if a halo lives in a very overdense environment, mm-hmm. and delta is large, then it accretes at a lower rate?
That's right, because it forms more molecular hydrogen.
What am I missing? I mean, I would expect the more gas you have, the more...
It's a different accretion rate.
That's
this
right.
Accretion rate is at a 0.1 parsec. The accretion rate of the halo is much higher.
Yeah. So what I'm saying here is that halos that form at higher redshift earlier in time form more molecular hydrogen. Okay? Halos that are in overdense regions, more overdense regions, form more molecular hydrogen. They tend to be hotter. They tend to have merged more to get to where they are. These are not completely orthogonal to each other. I mean, things that are in higher overdensity regions tend to be forming earlier in time as well.
So this refers to a very small time scale?
This refers to a very small spatial scale. So essentially what I'm doing is looking at gas that's accreting in the very central area of the halo, which is about 100 solar masses of gas enclosed, or maybe a tenth of a parsec, something like that. So this is the reservoir of gas that the protostar forms out of, like just the core of the halo.
The size of the protostar is only 100 solar masses.
That's right. That's right. That's where we stop our simulations. So essentially what I'm trying to do is we haven't evolved these things onto the main sequence, so I'm trying to make some inferences about what's going to happen. So does that make more sense?
Okay.
Okay. All right, sounds good. But the amount of molecular hydrogen explains it, so we can talk about it later. Anyway, so we've also learned that feedback from previous generations of POP3 stars, and by feedback I mean things like photodissociating or Lyman-Werder radiation, which breaks apart molecular hydrogen, and also photoionizing radiation, so eye fronts from neighboring halos and so on, and also cosmic rays from previous generations of structure formation can be very important. And so this is a plot of, let's see, what's the one thing that I really want you to take? So this is another paper that Mike and I did, and then there's a very similar thing by John Wise and Tom Abel, where we were essentially looking at the effects of a photodissociating background on the properties of gas in these halo cores. And so to do this, we took one simulation, so a single cosmological realization, and then just started cranking up the strength of this photodissociating background. So remember, I keep talking about how molecular hydrogen is the important coolant. If you turn up the UV background, the photodissociating background, you're destroying molecular hydrogen. Now, at some point, the halo will get large enough, the density will get high enough, that you actually form molecular hydrogen regardless of the strength of the UV background, but what does the halo look like when that happens? And so so this JLW is the strength of the Lyman-Werner background in some particular set of units. This is sort of the plausible range. Here, this open square right here, we're looking at the strength of the UV background versus the collapse redshift. And so this open square in all three of these plots is the simulation where there was no UV background, so the control sample. And then as you crank the UV background up, go to higher and higher strengths of it, we see that the collapse redshift is systematically delayed. So the delay of the collapse of gas, and when I'm saying collapse, I mean when does this gas really reach relatively high or cosmologically high densities, 10 to the 10 particles per cubic centimeter. And this just goes up and up and up. And so, but it does start to tail off. And I think at some point in John's simulation, in your simulations, you guys see that there's not that much of a difference, right? Or is there? In the collapse redshift. At the absolute highest strength of the UV background, will you?
Right.
Yeah, because you reach the point where it's just so hot. You form a little bit of molecular hydrogen and it cools like crazy.
Right. The argument was that the halos start making free electrons by shocks that happen at the halo center. Mm. And so even if you have a very strong UV background and you think I can't make any H2, as soon as the halo makes a little bit of free electrons, you now really boost the H2 formation rate.
Yeah.
And whatever background we have doesn't matter anymore.
Right. So so we see that as you turn up the UV background, the collapse redshift goes down, or the time that it collapses gets later and later. The virial mass goes up. There's this merger. There's several mergers in a very short period of time here, which is why this gets cranked up. But also, interestingly enough, the accretion rate at the center of the halo in this same kind of metric that I've been talking about before also seems to go up. So that's quite interesting, and it's just that since you're destroying molecular hydrogen, the gas doesn't cool as efficiently, so you have hotter gas in your halo core. So this could be important. So one thing that I did find interesting, and that I believe you guys also saw, was that even that these extremely massive halos, where the virial temperature is 9,000 Kelvin, almost 10,000 Kelvin, we still see a single core. We still see in each one of these, we don't see lots of stars forming, just still one. Okay, we're going to skip that. Okay. Yes. Jeez. So I'm eight slides in. Great. Okay. All right. Well then, I'm just going to show you what the current state of the art is. So this was my where are we now slide. So essentially, there's a whole lot of text here, but the gist of it is that Matt Turk, I haven't really done any of this other than provide him lots of moral support, has taken the work that Tom, Greg, and Mike did and extended it to add a lot of new physics and also extended numerical precision so that you can go up to many, many, many levels of adaptive mesh, about 42 levels in his best simulation thus far. Before the problem with having reduced floating point precision is that you can no longer particularly accurately position your grids, which makes things like keeping your hydrodynamics algorithm stable a bit of a challenge. If you can go to arbitrarily high precision, that problem goes away. So anyway, he added a bunch of physics, including chemistry that allows you to go to extremely high densities, and then effects of opacity. So as this primordial gas gets to high density, eventually it becomes optically thick, So that's all taken into account. So let's see.
How?
Okay. So let's see. So we take into account opacity to lines using this Ripamonti and Abel approximation, which Tom, I think, can comment on more knowledgeably than I can. And then also, there's some assumptions about opacity to continuum radiation. Crap. Tom, could you help me out? I forget the details.
So we did 1D radiation hydro with all the molecular lines. We included CAE coolants and continuum radiation that become important here. And then devise sort of an open state probability formulas that we showed what first in 1D. And so we said, okay, let's try this in 3D.
But that can depend on the velocity structure too.
Well, that's the nice thing in 1D.
Yeah.
I mean, so the 1D test we did absolutely perfect. Okay. And in 3D, of course, it can't be fully correct.
Right.
Okay.
But, I mean, in addition to this, you can do something like a Sobolev approximation, right? Like calculate local velocity divergence and
use
that.
I just wanted to know what the method was.
Yeah. So, not full radiation transport. So, okay. So, these are actually really hard to read. Anyway, but the point of this is that he has initialized this, so we're talking about roughly half megaparsec co-moving type volumes, initialized at extremely high redshift, assuming what's about a WMAP year 3 model except a higher sigma 8. Well, that's for reasons which we don't need to get into. And then we followed the evolution of this simulation from a redshift of about 166 down to the redshift of collapse, which is at about a redshift of 28, using up to 35 levels of adaptive mesh refinement. And so at the final output, and this is using super Lagrangian refinement criteria, so as you go to higher resolution, the mass resolution actually gets better. So at the final output, the maximum density that we've reached is a little above 10 to the 21 particles per cubic centimeter proper, a spatial resolution of about 10 to the 9 centimeters proper, that's about a 40th of a solar radii, and then a mass resolution of about 10 to the minus 8 solar masses. So the resolution gets to be extremely good. And I would like to note that while we're doing this with adaptive mesh, and you can definitely start talking about methodological differences, Naoki Yoshida sees startlingly similar results at some scales down to sort of less than a parsec resolution. When we get down to extremely high resolution, there are still some differences. But we are seeing a surprising amount of agreement between the two types of calculations. So,
what's the temperature in the center of the protostar at that entry?
You'll see it. Two slides. So,
my central value is
0.76. Yeah, but
that would delay a lot the formation.
That's correct. Though, we can talk about cosmological parameters later, I think. That's for historical reasons.
So,
yeah. Though I think that there's still enough slop in the sigma 8 debate that the WMAP, I mean, for example. Yes, I know it's not WMAP year 3. That's why I said WMAP 3 plus sigma 8. Something different. Okay, so anyway, all right. So, I don't have enough time to really show you these results in detail. So essentially what we've seen is that the evolution's quite similar to previous simulations of this type, where what we're looking at here is the baryon number density in particles per cc as a function of radius. Note that this is AU. So we go towards higher and higher densities. This is very centrally concentrated. The density profile is roughly 1 over r to the 2.2. And as we go to, and so at the end of our simulations, when we stop at about 10 to the 21, there's only a very tiny amount of gas at that density. So, for example, within an AU where the gas is above maybe 10 to the 16, we're looking at less than a solar mass of gas, significantly less than a solar mass of gas. And so you can see sort of typical evolution in all of these different quantities. Temperature, this is temperature, radial velocity, molecular hydrogen fraction. So you see at large scales, the gas goes up to about the virial temperature, cools down, and then as you reach LTE, the temperature starts going back up again, and then I would like to put all these in the same plot, except then you can't, or the same page, except then you can't see it. And then the temperature goes up, and this is corresponding to where you've reached about as effective of cooling as you possibly can, this is in an optically thin or an optically thick regime, and molecular hydrogen starting to get photodissociated. And so the velocity structure of this is such that it's slowly, you know, gas is slowly moving in at large radii. And then finally, when I finish up our simulation, we see, or when Matt finishes the simulations, I should say, we see this accretion shock where the velocity actually goes down to about 10 kilometers per second onto this inner protostellar, onto this protostellar core that has a mass of around a hundredth of a solar mass. And so the thing that I had wanted to talk about the most was how we calculate the accretion rates. And so this is really where we estimate the mass of this star and where I think a lot of confusion comes in, judging by the talk on Wednesday and by previous talks I've heard. So what we're looking at here is, on the left, it's the accretion rate in solar masses per year. So that's one solar mass a year, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 4, as a function of enclosed gas mass. So remember, our protostar is way down here, and then the inner parsec or so of this whole simulation corresponds to a little bit less than 1,000 solar masses. So what we do to calculate this accretion rate is at the last time step of our simulation, when this has gone up to an incredibly high density, the Courant condition effectively kills us. We have to stop the simulations and then just make some guesses. And so what we do is then at this last time step, we get the spherically averaged radial velocity, density, and so on, and just calculate the mass flux past shells. And so this here, this is the mass flux, the accretion rate past given spherical shells. And so you could, and then one can infer the growth of the object, of the star at the center, in the absence of any sort of feedback. And so what you could say is that, just look at this last line here, what we could say is that as a function of time, the star will reach an enclosed mass following this mass of sort of this line. So how you could read this is after about 10,000 years, it's going to have a mass of 20 or 30 solar masses. After a million years, it'll have a mass of 1,000 solar masses. So then you can apply arguments like, what is the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale? Well, it'll probably evolve onto the main sequence on about the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale. So that gives you a minimum mass. And then the maximum mass, which is probably a little bit more certain than that, is what is the main sequence lifetime of a star of this mass? And so once the star blows up, it probably will stop accreting. So that's your maximum mass. And so this range is in the, you know, tens to hundreds of solar masses. So that is really where we get our mass estimate of a POP3 star. And that's fine, and it's what we've been able to do, but this ignores radiative feedback, angular momentum, and so on. And so I'm going to argue in mere moments that we need to move past this. Okay, don't need to worry about that. Yeah. Am I done?
Well, you can do it.
Okay. So, all right. So, what's next? So, what I wanted to say was that when we calculate these, when we estimate these mass ranges of our stars, I mean, we're really looking at a snapshot with a very tiny protostar, not the massive protostar, and definitely not the evolution of the gas at small scales. I mean, we're assuming spherical symmetry. We're assuming that angular momentum and radiative feedback are unimportant. And all of these are not great assumptions. So none of this stuff can be ignored. And so what's really been driving my thoughts on this is a paper by Jonathan Tan and Chris, and then one that is coming out soon. John tells me. Oh, okay. So I've seen a couple very early drafts of that manuscript, but I mean, where this is discussed in great detail, and it's clear that all of these assumptions need to be looked at very, very carefully. So to move past this, what do we have to do? So first off, we ignore a lot of physics. We need to worry about radiation transport, probably with both point and diffuse sources. So the protostar being the point source, and diffuse source being recombination radiation. So we might have to worry about multi-group and multi-frequency transport. And then also this is going to be coupled very strongly to this primordial chemistry. We're going to have to worry about MHD, which will likely be non-ideal. And then, of course, we have to worry about different equations of state and also stellar evolution. I mean, as gas accretes onto the star, it's going to change its radiative properties a lot, and that's important. We will talk about that later. This is, I'm talking about in the cores of these halos, but something like an MRI seeded by cosmological magnetic fields. We'll talk about it later. So I'm going to just throw down the gauntlet and say that for these simulations, we need to just get rid of cosmology. And my argument for this is as follows. I mean, we're looking at boxes that are half a megaparsec. The area of interest for the actual, you know, simulating the evolution of this star is about 2 parsecs across, something like that. I mean, it's evolving so quickly that it's effectively decoupled from the rest of the universe, and it's something like 10 to the minus 12 of the volume, of the total volume of our simulation. And so what that tells me is that, I mean, this is, we need to throw away the cosmology. This is really an astrophysics problem. I mean, this little piece of this big simulation is so decoupled, we can just ignore this stuff. So anyway, so let me just conclude, and I apologize for running over my 15 minutes. So what we've done, we, the population of POP3 simulators have done, is simulate scales ranging from megaparsecs, or significant fractions of megaparsecs, down to tiny fractions of a parsec, including all of the physics that's relevant at those scales, with startlingly good agreement between methods. And so in our simulations, we see a variety of inferred accretion rates onto these stars. Everything that we've seen in cosmological simulations indicates that we're going to see massive stars. But, I mean, how massive? We really have no idea. So I would argue that our current fundamental problem is lack of physics in our simulation, not lack of resolution. We can achieve whatever resolution we need to, but we really have a lot to go on in the physics. And so I would argue very strongly that we need to really understand this sort of last parsec problem. I mean, we have to move past the cosmology codes and do something that's a lot more analogous to like what Mark does, for example. So anyway, thank you.
Okay, well, Ed, while he's getting set up,
We're not spending any computing time, but it's dragging the simulations down because you have to carry, you know, huge amounts of data around for the halo, for everything else. It's actually a gigantic pain. I mean, it's very,
it doesn't compute at all.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, when you start doing MHD, radiation transport, evolving the chemistry, it's all.
Comment that is very relevant to this discussion. I think I agree with what you say, but I think what you need to throw away is not the outer scale of the cosmology. What you need to throw away is the 42 level inward. So you need to put the same particle in the middle, and that's going to
solve
the problem. Not probably.
This is actually one of the slides that I jumped past.
Okay.
But yes, exactly. I mean,
so
you mean, see the problem.
So Ed,
here's the. I turned it off. So yes, that's quite true. I mean, in these simulations, we currently stop them because it's Courant limited. I mean, you go down to 40 odd level of confinement, and you're actually at some point computing in sub real time. And for cosmological or astrophysical systems, that's not really desirable, right? So, we're going to have to put sink particles in to deal with that Courant condition. And in addition, those sink particles are going to have to accrete gas and spit radiation back out and possibly feedback outflows, things like that. So, just from a practical standpoint, most of the simulation volume and most of the data that you're lugging around is completely irrelevant. So that's more of a practical issue than anything else.
Okay, why don't we thank
Okay,